I'm Shalina Tobin, and today I'm joined by the most musical chef of them all, Graham Garrett. Born in the East End of London, Graham toured the world as a drummer in a number of rock and roll bands before hanging up his drumsticks at the West House restaurant in Kent. His unique flair quickly earned him many accolades, including a Michelin star that he subsequently held for 15 years. We talk about the highs and lows about that and so much more coming up. Graham, how are you?
I'm good, thank you very much. All right.
So nice to meet you. Thank you so much for giving us your time today.
You're welcome.
So, Graham, we just want to talk about your very first love of music. Have you rekindled any of that during the lockdown that we've had?
Yeah, massively. I mean, to be honest, it never really went away. You know, it stays with you, doesn't it? So, yeah, I just have more time to listen to stuff.
Yeah, so, you haven't been like banging away at drums?
Little bit. I've been indulging. I've been doing a few things. I've got a couple of projects on the go as well, which is kind of weird.
Oh, so nice. Tell us about that.
Well, I've actually, this is quite strange. So I've still got a lot of musician friends, obviously. And about a year and a half, 2 years ago, a good friend of mine, his daughter is very talented. They live out in Spain, out in Avia. And her and her boyfriend started, they were writing songs and doing little wine bars and that. And I started playing them to my friend in England, bass player. So his name's Jerry Meehan. He plays for Robbie Williams and Roxy Music, awesome. All of the people. And so we decided, like, get them over and record them and just for a bit of fun and do stuff. So we've ended up, yeah, over the last year and a half or so, actually doing an album with them.
Amazing.
So I've been co-producing an album and playing on it and all kinds of things, which is very, very bizarre from a departure from the kitchen.
But that's so much fun because, I mean, you played for bands like Yaya and Dumb.
Yeah, well, that was, you know, but as I always say, that's another life, you know, it was a lifetime ago. Yeah. And, but yeah, it's, you know, I hadn't played. I mean, literally hadn't played properly or anything for 25, 30 years. I can't remember. I don't count because it makes me feel too old. But, you know, I hadn't played for that long. So it's been interesting. And yeah, it's been quite cool. We have some really good people playing on it and, you know, friends.
Brilliant. And you travel the world as well. I mean, did you use that as inspiration for your food, like cooking?
Yeah, massively. You don't realise at the time, obviously, because, you know, the plan, when you're on tour and yeah. you're playing stadiums and that, the plan was never to be a chef, you know. Yeah. It's not like, oh, I can't wait for this to end so I can get in the kitchen. That just, you know, that just happened. But yeah, you soak it all up, don't you? You know, if you're into food, it's like anything. It's like you see it's everywhere. So when you're being taken out to great restaurants, you know, you land in LA to do a video or something and the record company take you to the local hotspot, wherever it is at the time, yeah. you know, you can't help but sort of get into all that. I always loved restaurants, loved food. You know, I read cookery books as a kid. I cooked anyway. It was a hobby. Yeah. So, yeah, it's, you know, that's where you get everything from, really, traveling.
So after your touring lifestyle, your first proper job was actually as a butcher. And that was the early signs of things to come. So that was when you probably realised that you could go into being a chef, or was it at that point?
No, because the butchery actually came first. So, you know, I was playing music as a kid. But when you want to leave school and you have careers, masters and stuff, you know, you have to go and see and go through all that rigmarole of what you want to do. You get offered the local factory or the army was about my two choices back in them days. And, you know, when I said I'm a musician, I want to be a musician or I want to be a rock star, I literally got the cane for it. Oh, so, you know, great, great teaching methods.
Yeah, that would never happen now.
So I needed a proper job, as you know, to be able to get straight out of school. I was only 15 to get out of school. And you know, as soon as I got my NI number, I was away. So I ended up doing butchery. You know, I went to my first job interview was at a Jewish slaughterhouse in Canning Town called Ziff Meats, if I remember rightly. Wow, you know, that was weird, an eye-opener, and it kind of was a bit off-putting, to be honest. And I thought, well, that's not for me. And at the time, butchers and that was all going under. There was a big chain called Dewhurst. I remember writing to them. I was writing to people like Dewhurst. I was also writing to like record shops, like Our Price Records, for see if I could work at a record shop or anything. But ended up Sainsbury's on the meat counter until I realised that the only butchery I was learning there was how to price up a frozen chicken and put it in the counter. But then I went off and done the equivalent of what would have been an apprenticeship, but they'd all ended then. But it was like a proper old-fashioned butcher shop with old guys in there teaching me and, you know, and giving me books and talking to me. But they all used to swap recipes and stuff as well. So the ladies would come in the shop and buy cuts of meat and they'd tell them how to cook them and stuff. So I'd get bits and pieces, go home and make dinner, you know, make stuff.
Family. But actually, in hindsight, it's a pretty cool place to work because you learnt butchery and actually you were getting loads of cooking tips as well. And wasn't that where you had a chance meeting with Neil Pass, who was working at Rules?
No, that was later. So that was the what I'd say the arse end of the music career.
Okay. You
know, so I'd done the butchery thing and was doing the music alongside. And what really happened then was, you know, I was out gigging of a night. I was out all night. I was going straight to work the next day and then obviously cutting myself to pieces and stuff. Well, not a great job playing with knives and butchery and that for a drummer. So I then gave up all of that. I went professional and music was it then for the next, I don't know, 10, 15 years, whatever. It was when that came to an end or was coming to an end. I was helping a friend out in a pub. They had a pub in Covent Garden. It was next door to Rawls Restaurant.
Yeah.
And I was just helping them out in the kitchen one day just for a bit of fun and, you know, helping behind the bar, everything. And that's when Neil Pass came in and I met him and he invited me in. He said, if you're interested, you want to see what service is like, come down. And he invited me down to Rawls. I always remember it was a lunch, I stuck on the fish section. Of the chef de partie on the fish section was a Vietnamese guy. Didn't really speak any English. All the orders were sort of through the tannoy. We'd done God knows how many hundred and whatever for lunch. It was chaos. So I had no idea what was going on. But there was such a buzz. It was kind of scary, but cool, if you know what I mean. And kind of, that's when it got me, really.
Yeah. And so, I mean, from there, was that when you decided to go to Westminster Catering College?
Yeah, well, Neil said I should carry on. I went back and done an evening service there. He gave me some phone numbers of agencies, but I didn't feel comfortable with that. So he said, you know, I said, I want to learn. So I went to Westminster, or I applied to Westminster as day release, saying I worked at Rawls and I was going there on a day release. I never actually had a job at all. So I lied. And then I got, yeah... Well, I thought I'd got caught out after about 6-7 weeks, but I hadn't. Well, they called me in and said, what's your story? So I came clean, said, I don't really work at Rawls. I'm a musician, blah, blah, blah. And they said, oh, the reason they were calling me in was a chef lecturer there was opening a restaurant in Holborn, and he wondered if I wanted to go and work there. Go and work with him. I had no way. I couldn't then sort of backtrack. I opened a restaurant called Christoph's in Park Walk, which was next door. But one to the aubergine.
Okay.
So Gordon was, you know, always in the kitchen, or I was in his, usually in his reception eating his petit fours. He used to do these nice little ice cream or sorbet petit fours. We used to sit and munch over coffee and that. So we was always in each other's restaurant. And we became quite friendly. So, you know, before that happened, I was always badgering him. When he opened the aubergine, I was badgering him for a stage down there. But that's it. I never actually ever worked for him.
Oh, okay. Pretty tough guy to work with, I could imagine.
I would imagine from what I've seen and know. Yeah, I don't regret not working for him, put it that way.
And so, okay, so you did go and work with Nico Ledennis, right?
Yeah. That so from Christoph's, after we opened, so it was Holborn, then I'd done a couple of other things, and we opened Christoph's, was there for a while. And then it was Nico and Roy Ackerman at the time, restaurant partnership. They were opening a chain, or they were trying to open a chain of Simply Nico's and Nico Centrals. And they were interested in one in Chelsea and they liked the Christoph's site. They come and ate at Christoph's. Right. We chatted. In the end, they asked me if they got involved or if they bought the restaurant, if I would stay and head it up for them. So I was quite like, wow, you know, Nico is like God, you know. So I agreed to that. He then invited me down to Park Lane. I then went and worked in all the other Nicos. That went on. But at that time, I don't know, I'd been offered another job. It was opening, so Soho House existed at the time, and they were just about to open Babington House out in Somerset. Mm-hmm. And I got asked to do that, and I worked on the whole, you know, I went down to Babington when it was just a building site. We helped, you know, I was in the meetings every month. We were setting up, like, the gardens with Monty Don and, you know, everything. It was working out what went where, how we were going to do it. The whole concept is quite exciting. And then just when it was about to our house, they sorted me out a house in Frome I was going to move to. Everything was going ahead. Just about to leave Nico and the whole thing. And we had a sort of leaving party. And they said, what, you know, what could we do to tempt you to stay? And I said, well, nothing. It's all done now. And they offered me executive chef, all these openings and you name it. Kind of went back with a shopping list and they said yes to all of it. And I thought, well, I'd be mad not to. None of it came true that was on the list, but that's another story. But yeah, so I ended up staying. So I ended up running about 7 restaurants, I think, in the end for them.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Well, so at that point, I mean, how much, I mean, if you're running 7 restaurants at the same time, how much chefing are you actually doing? Is it, does it turn more into like, you know, a business venture then?
That was the problem. So you'd think that being exec over 7 restaurants would basically be an office job, which I didn't want. But the way they done it, it was a slightly dodgy organization in the end. And they wanted you to be, they almost wanted you to be in every restaurant. So I'd go and do an opening and end up staying there for 3 or 6 months, but they'd still expect me to be head chef and running the restaurant I'd just left. Right. And it was impossible. I had key people I used to take with me, but you know, I can remember at one time, you know, leaving Chelsea, I had a motorbike. I drove to Heathrow. I'd done service in Heathrow. I went back to Chelsea to put the bins out. I went to the Barbican on the way home to finish up. It just got out of hand, you know. And then one day when we done London Bridge, it had been weeks and weeks, like 7 days a week, and it finally got to a weekend where it was, we were shut or whatever, I could have a day off. And they said, no, you've got to be in Manchester at 7 o'clock in the morning. We've got an answer. Like, no, you know. And it, I had to do it. So it was nearly put me over the edge. I mean, that was the most tricky, depressing, difficult time ever. And it was getting out of that. Yeah, because I was also paid, I was supposed to get paid on bonuses, so for every opening I'd done. And I never got any of that. I mean, I never got any money. And I was just working and working. And, you know, the conditions were terrible. And I was responsible for everything. It was a very difficult, ended up in court. It was a difficult time. But, you know, all's well that ends well, as they say. If you just battle through it, you know, that usually you learn from everything. Doesn't matter how shit a situation, you benefit from it eventually, I think. I hope.
But, I mean, it sounds so demanding, but I mean, was that what drove you to open your own restaurant then?
Sorry, my internet connection just went dodgy there.
So I was just saying that sounded really, really demanding, but you know, to take in sort of like positives out of, you know, kind of situations like that. Is that what drove you to open your own restaurant? And did you finally say, right, I can do this?
Yeah, I think opening my own restaurant was always an ambition. I mean, when I was in music, you know, my ambition then being into food and everything else, I always had this thing, like me and Ray, the guitar player and that, we always said, oh, we'd get a really cool bar. I always wanted like a speakeasy type bar where whatever bands or musicians in town would be at, you know, they'd come down, people drink, and I think, and then there'd be a little stage so people could get up and play or whatever and jam, and then there'd be food. So I thought, oh, this is great. I can get pissed. I can play a bit and cook a bit. That was my plan. I had no idea how the industry worked at that time. So it was always an idea. Even when I got into restaurants and cooking in the end, I thought, yeah, you know, the end goal would be to have my own something or other. But I will say that through the the hard, you know, the experience of everything I'd done and worked for, and especially the Nico thing and that. Yeah, that gave me the sort of knowledge, I suppose, and the tools to be able to do what I do now. Otherwise, it would just never happen, you know.
So basically, yeah. You opened up in 2002. You opened up the West House in Bindon, which you still have today. Yeah. You're originally an East London boy. So yeah. how did you end up in Kent? Tell me how you decided to go there.
I was working for Richard Corrigan at the time. So we had the house and the English Garden over in Chelsea. And long story, but basically they were going to get rid of the English house, or the house as it was called then. They wanted me to take it over because I was chef patron there and all the rest of it. Mm. I wanted to get out of London. It didn't make sense traveling as well from East London to Chelsea every day and back. It was killer. You know, time you finished of a night, there's no tubes or anything, so it was getting a bit rough.
Yeah.
And I was trying to get out, and they sent a property agent in to sort of half convince me to take it on and to kind of price the plate and have a deal. I got talking to the property agent, told him that I was trying to get out of town. And I was, at the time, I'd looked at places down in, like, believe it or not, Marlow pubs and stuff. And you know, around sort of Buckinghamshire and Bedfordshire, that's, you know, all around that corner. And, He was saying to me, why do you want to go? Everyone goes down there. You know, why don't you come? Why don't you look in Kent? And I was like, where's that? no idea where Kent was. I since found out I obviously knew loads of places in Kent. I just didn't know they were in Kent.
Kent's massive.
That's the wrong side of the water. So, yeah, that was it. And he arranged a day. This agent said, well, look, you know, if I arrange a day, pick you up at the station, take you around, show you a few places in Kent. So yeah, no harm in looking. So that's what we've done. We come down and I looked at a few pubs, bits and pieces, and nothing really. And on the way back, he said, I've just got to go into this restaurant and get the people they're moving, got to get them to sign some papers. He said, do you mind waiting? So I said, no. And and it was the West House. I think it was a ploy. I don't think it was old.
It sounds a little
bit like typical that. Estate agent. Cynic in me says I was completely set up for that at the end of the day. But it's weird because I was looking for, I wanted a pub. I didn't want a restaurant at all. I was done with restaurants. And I saw my future in a pub. And but when I came in, you know, when you walk in somewhere, it's like you think, oh, well, this is okay, you know. And it was playing in my mind all the time, and I kept looking at it, and you know. So, and 10 months later, we moved in. Yeah, but it took a little while to get it all sorted.
Oh,
but
really?
Yeah, we moved in in the May and opened on June the 21st, Midsummer's Day. So just under a month, I moved in, set the restaurant up, turned it around totally on my own. I had no help, wow. And no one.
And did your wife Jackie? Your partner Jackie? Did she feel the same way about moving to Kent? Was it a family decision?
Probably not. No.
So you said this is what we're doing, and
well, it was, you know, it's a little bit. You obviously have to agree stuff, don't you? But I mean, it, you know, the moving seemed like the right thing to do at the time. The kids were little and stuff, and yeah, I mean, we obviously talked about it and worked it out and decided that it would be the way forward.
Yeah.
It's funny, isn't it, when you look back at what drives you and, you know, and how things get their own momentum and they happen, you know, they just happen. Where you look back now, you think, God, would you do it again? You know, I don't regret doing it, obviously, and the outcome was good, but when I think how we done it and what I've done, it's like you would never go into that knowingly, you know. You just wouldn't do it.
Well, it turned out, you know, it's turned out to be a family affair. So your son Jake works in the restaurant as well with you now. And did he cook? Was he interested in the cooking side of things?
At the start, so when we first moved here, he was 10. And he, you know, the novelty of him helping me in the kitchen was good. I was on my own. But what happens when you're on your own and under a lot of pressure is you start relying on any help that you've got. And before long, you're relying on a 10-year-old to weigh out your bread mixes, make all your biscuit mixes. Then he was like, you know, I had him boning chickens, and, you know, he was obviously scrubbing all the muscles and picking the spinach.
Wow.
And it was, it, you know, it was too much. And where I was under a bit of pressure as well, you start, no, do it right, do this, do that. And you end up a bit, you know, Gordon Ramsay-ish on a 10-year-old. So that ended. But then I thought, you know what, it's good to put them off. You know, if they really want to do it, then, you know, it's the reality, isn't it?
Well, he couldn't have been that bad because he's still working with you today.
But the thing is, that was it. He then went off and done his own thing. But then when it came time to, you know, leave school and do whatever, you know, he wanted to do it. And he came out front, and now he runs out front. But, you know, obviously he can cook, and it's great because he likes food and understands food and restaurants. Obviously, he's in the industry for a long time now and eats out everywhere. Yeah. So he kind of knows what you're doing. So it's good like that. But he's great. He does all the wine. He does all the wine list and everything for me. And I don't have to get involved, which is nice.
Oh, so let's talk about the West House. I mean, your first year was it 2002, wasn't it? And then, so 2004, you received your first star. What did that do for business?
It really did make a difference at the time, because obviously the amount of stuff around it. So you think we opened midsummer 2002. I don't remember getting an inspection till about, it was probably 2003 or thereabouts, they come in and spoke to us. And the guide used to come out then in the January. So it was the January 2004 guide that came out.
Yeah, they're going back to that now.
Yeah, I know. So it was pretty quick. And I think, you know, we was always busy of a weekend, because that's being in the country. But then we started, obviously the demand went up because of the amount of press. So for that year, the year you get it, you know, because we had like the BBC came and filmed for the local news or whatever, and, you know, saying we got started. I didn't even know they were coming. They're outside on a Monday when we're closed in the dark in the winter filming, and you're in all the local papers and that. So it just raised an awareness to people that didn't know we were here, because I didn't come down and do any PR or anything. I mean, the first thing that happened, funny enough, that was the January that happened. In the December, we got we were finalists for the best restaurant outside of London in the Harpers and Queen, Moët Chandon Harpers and Queen thing. So, you know, we tried to go to Claridge's for, and that was a bigger shocker at the time. So it kind of all happened at once. Suddenly you start to, you know, it raises awareness, and that's the good thing about it.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it's unusual at that time for pubs to receive Michelin stars as well, kind of that style of food. It was more of, you know, fine dining and, you know.
Yeah, well, we were, you know, we're a small restaurant. So I was trying to cook not what I was doing in London. Well, in London, we used to do it a bit as well. We sort of tried to, you know, before it was, everybody was talking about seasonal and that was my thing. You know, I used to, especially working with Corrigan and that, you know, it was all about the ingredients, trying to be as seasonal as possible. And we, you know, I used to think I was running a little country restaurant when I was in Chelsea. So when we came here and started doing the same thing, but with all the produce that was on your doorstep, you know, it was a good thing. And it was a struggle then, because trying to do this local and seasonal thing when no one else was doing it was difficult, because, you know, you go, like, we had a veg supplier down the road, fantastic, you know, but he didn't sell any local veg. He sold Peruvian asparagus. You had to pre-order your strawberries or your herbs 3 days ahead. It's like, why, you know? It took a long time with suppliers and farms driving around. I spent so much effort in, you know, trying to source products, whereas now it's, you know, it's a lot different to how it was. But I suppose it was, you know, it's getting on for 19 years ago, you know. So I suppose there would be a change, wouldn't there?
Yeah, absolutely. Things have changed a lot. And yeah. So going back to the whole Michelin star thing. So in the 2020 guide, and you found out that you didn't retain your star for the first time in 15 years.
16, yeah. 16. We had it for 16, so that would have been 17th.
Yeah.
That would have been 17th consecutive one, yeah. But
so do you know what it was that changed for you?
Well, you can never, I mean, you you could only know 100% if they were to tell you exactly what it was, and they have no, they don't have any correspondence with you at all, do they? So, you know, you can only guess or know in your own mind. So yeah, I've got a few ideas of things that had changed a little bit. We changed the offer. We're now a restaurant with rooms. We're not the tiny little husband and wife team, as they like to call it, you know, with just me cooking. You know, now I have chefs as well cooking, you know. And I also went for a period before that of having as I was doing more things, the book, building the rooms, trying to expand the business, obviously you delegate more. So I brought in a head chef and that kind of thing, and it didn't work. So, you know, I wasn't cooking when we lost the star.
Right. So have you gone back in the kitchen now as a
result? Oh, yeah. Well, not just because of that. I mean, funny enough, I'd gone back in the kitchen just before that happened, and you saw the difference straight away in your customers and your comments and your online reviews and everything, and business. And at the end of the day, you know, it's not about Michelin or any other guidebook. It's about your customers. I know it's an old cliche and a lot of people say it, but, you know, I'm running a business. If I don't have happy customers coming in the restaurant, I don't have a business. Yeah. Therefore, you know, I wouldn't have anything. No accolades. I'd have nothing. I wouldn't have an income. So that's really all you need to focus on. And I always say to people, focus on that and the rest comes, if it does. And if you've got a full restaurant, it doesn't really matter if you've got how many rosette stars or anything else you've got. It's irrelevant.
So did losing the star make any difference on your clientele? You're still full?
No, we're busier.
Oh, wow.
That's the most interesting thing. But we're probably not, you know, I doubt we're busier because of that. I think we're just busier because we're better than when we had it or when we lost it. We had a period of time with other stuff that obviously wasn't as good, maybe. I don't know. Certainly from the minute I sort of went back in, got a grip of it, changed things around, new team, fantastic. And it's been amazing ever since. And then lockdown comes, which is a shame because it devastates everything. When we did open again, we opened at the beginning of August again, and I had to change the offer a bit because of what had gone on, and, you know, slightly reduced working hours and stuff to reduced covers, but bloody hell, I mean, we were totally rammed every day, lunch and dinner, and the rooms, all the rooms were full. So, you know,
that's amazing.
Unfortunately, then we had to shut again. So, you know, November, you know, I was expecting a rubbish November because it's November. But we would have been full all the way through. I had to sort of refund all the rooms and try and move stuff. And that's when, you know, when people are saying, okay, we won't cancel our room or whatever. We're in the rock and roll room. When's the next available Saturday night that we can have it? And you'd look in the diary and you go, nothing till sort of end of Jan, February. And we don't take bookings much further ahead than that anyway. So it's great to know, you know, the customer support's been amazing. Some people were really angry. Customers were angry about the star thing, losing it, because they were saying it doesn't make sense. And others don't know. Others don't give a shit. So, you know.
Yeah. So on a personal level, so just kind of like removing yourself from the customers and the food, I mean, how did you feel personally about losing the star?
At first, when it first happens, obviously you feel quite down because you take it personally. You think, you know, you start, you start questioning your ability. So I think it dents your confidence a bit. And then you start searching for reasons why, you know, and you blame yourself for everything, because ultimately this whole place is mine and it's about me. And so, you know, the buck stops with you, doesn't it? So, but it took, I got some amazing phone calls the next morning and messages and that, but I got phone calls from some like big names in the industry and stuff that were phoning just to say, you know, they'd either been through it or knew what you were going through. And the message, the clear message I got from them all was, you don't suddenly become shit overnight. So don't, you know, just carry on. Don't worry about it.
Yeah.
And you know, and you think, yeah, okay. So that gives you a little confidence boost and it makes you carry on. And like with everything, you get down, you dust yourself off, then you get back in there and you go and you come back stronger. And But I say it's not, for me, it's not, at the start, I feel good, you know, the boys in the kitchen, oh, we'll just have to get it back, you know, they want to win it back and all that. That's the attitude at the start, which is good. My attitude as time's gone on from that, though, is like, actually, been there, done it. 16 years consecutively, I don't really care. I left London to get away from all of that madness. My original thing was, you know, working for your Nikos and that of the world. It's like, let's just go away where it's more about the food. I just wanted to get back to cooking, like get great produce, cook what I wanted when I wanted, you know, and be in charge of my own destiny. That was basically it. It weren't any big plan, money or anything else, no empire building. It was just about cooking. It was about the food. And that's all it was. So when you sort of strip everything back, that's all that matters. And if you do that and you've got people that enjoy it, you know, the rest can do what they want. They can write about you what they want. If they want to, you know, it's great. Accolades are great because it generates, like I said, when we first got it, it generates PR. And it's become, you know, it used to be you couldn't even mention you had anything. You know, you couldn't use it on your website. You couldn't use it. Nowadays, you can't turn the telly on without hearing the dreaded N word. You know what I mean? It's like, oh, I'll give it a rest. People didn't even know what it was before unless they... You know, it's a few people that used to buy the book. Now, I don't know, who buys guidebooks now anyway, really? You know, well, you were sitting there, you got Instagram, you got everything.
Yeah. I think a lot of chefs buy them, right? I mean, whenever I go to restaurants, there's tons of books sitting on their shelves. They get it every year if they're in it. But yeah. You're right, I think everything's...
I find that weird as well, but there you go.
Pardon?
I said I find that a bit weird as well. It's like...
Well, I guess, you know, they're probably just very proud of having
it. Yeah, well, it's, you know, it's like they used to say, it's the chef's Oscar and all of that. But I mean, it's not really, is it? I mean, it's, you know, it's good. It's good to have. It's certainly a good ego thing,
yeah.
Chefs and that. And it was losing it, dent your ego a little bit. But you've got to be realistic. And I've said this before, but we're all just, it's just food. We're all cooking a bit of dinner. That's it.
You know? So dare I ask your aspirations to get it back? It sounds like you're fine either way, but
yeah.
do you want to get it back?
Not for myself. The boys in the kitchen, you know, they'd like to because then rather than coming to work somewhere that's got one, they feel that they've been part of achieving it.
Yeah.
So for them. And for their CV and for their growth and all that, fantastic. And team thing, that's great, yeah. But it's hard to get that enthusiasm for yourself when, like I say, you come away from all of that madness and then you end up getting one. You keep it for that long. You know, I'd be happier to know that I'd, you know, if someone said COVID and all these problems and everything that's going on and the industry's in turmoil at the moment, you know, what would you choose, a Michelin star or to know that your business will be sound and busy and secure for the next 5 years or whatever? What are you going to choose? You know, let's face it, it's, you know, they all, it's another tool, isn't it? It's another part of keeping your business current or known about. And, you know, that's what it's good for. Yeah. It's good to be in any guidebook. You know, the more you're in, more the merrier. You know, it helps, but it's not. It should never be a goal. It never was for me. Mm. It just happened. Mm. I came in the industry so late that I didn't ever think it was even a possibility. So you know, it should never be anyone's aim. And you hear a lot of that. A lot of young chefs, it's their goal, and they go into a kitchen, and everything's about achieving that, trying to get a star, and that's all they talk about. And I think focus on the food. Focus on the food, focus on the restaurant, and, you know, happy customers, then worry about the rest. The rest will come on its own, you know. It's putting the emphasis in the wrong place, as far as I'm concerned.
So do you think that there are mental health issues within chefs today because there's too much pressure coming from wanting a Michelin star?
There probably is for some chefs, but they're bringing that on themselves, aren't they? Because there is no pressure, is there?
No.
Unless, you know, No one goes into anything. It's I've got to do this. You know, who's putting you under pressure for that? It's yourself. If that's your goal, you know. When I look back to the days of, you know, your Marco and Gordon and all of that stuff, you know, and there was only a few, you know, handful of free stars. Well, still are, but their whole game, you know, their whole game plan was, their whole thing in life was to get that third star. That's all they wanted to do. That's their focus. And that's all they cared about, and that's fine. And that's their thing. But that's not everybody's, is it? And it shouldn't be. And not everybody's capable of that anyway. So why put yourself under that pressure? I mean, if that's how you are and that's what you want to do, then great. But then you should be able to handle that pressure, shouldn't you? If you can't, then stop being an idiot and just cook, you know. Yeah. Don't worry about it.
Yeah, yeah. Totally agree. So moving on. I know you've done some work to the restaurant to sit 35 now and maybe include a chef's table. What are the other plans that you have once we're out the other side of the pandemic?
I don't know, because plans change. I was never great at planning. I kind of better at drifting into things and, you know, stuff that happened and then call it fate. But, you know, as we went along, we wanted to do a cookery school and then a chef's table thing. That wasn't allowed because of planning permissions and that in the end, that came down to the rooms. We just got the four bedrooms. That took 3 years to get through and to build and everything.
Wow, that's a long time.
I know. I mean, and a lot of money. You know, it's different, two different architects, and, you know, you've got to get the right people to do the right
building. Is that why it took so long?
Yeah, we're a listed building and in a conservation area.
Oh.
And every other problem that you would never imagine crops up during a project. So, you know, but you get to a point where you're so far into something, you've invested so much time, effort and money into something that you think, oh, I've got to keep going. Otherwise, you just think, oh, forget that then. Yeah. So that's, you know, but it's worked. But just before the last lock, not the first, just before the first lockdown, I was involved in something in Cape Town in South Africa, and I was opening, and I would have been doing a restaurant there with Luke Dale Roberts from the Test Kitchen. We had a project we were doing, and we were launching in June. That was happening. That completely out the water when they shut down and we shut down. So that's kind of gone. I think I can't see that coming back now. You know, we might do something eventually different or something, but that project's gone, which is a shame. So you put a lot of focus into things and, you know, or money or whatever into stuff to try and, you know, it has to be right as well. There's a lot of stuff that's gone on or I could have done or got involved in, but I've never lost sight of the focus here. You know, I always think this is the restaurant, the West House is my thing.
Yeah.
It's my home. It's, you know, it's the baby. So I can't just go and do other things, and, you know, you can't split yourself into two. I don't have hundreds of staff where you can do that. It's always been quite tight.
Well, so, as you know, you're the one that's needed in the kitchen, no one else. So you can't, which is a shame. But you've cooked for some pretty amazing guests, including the Queen.
All of our guests. the Queen was a weird one. Not her person, she wasn't weird. It was a... She's lovely.
So what kind of conversation did you have?
It started off, we had this woman come in. She'd been recommended to us. This was when I was at the house in Chelsea. And she said, we want to do a dinner party, a little private dinner party for 10, private room. Showed her the room and everything. Talked sort of through menus and stuff. And she was a bit awkward, and she kept saying, "Oh, yeah, but I'm slightly worried about the menu." And I said, "Well, don't worry." And she kept everything, you know, was an issue, and you just felt, you know, don't said to her, "Look, we've had all kinds of people in here, you know, from like prime ministers to all, you know, to rock stars." I said, "That's what we do. Don't worry, you know, we'll sort out the menu with you. We'll take care of everything. It'll all be fine." She said, "But I want to bring someone. I've got this special guest I'd really like to invite." And I said, "Well, like I say, we've had them all. Don't matter. Harrison Ford, happy. Everyone else happy." And she said, well, you know, I'd really like to invite the Queen. And at that point, I thought, oh, you nutter. You know what I mean? I just thought, I just thought she was a bit dotty, to be honest. So I said, yeah, well, I said, I'm sure she'd love it, you know. Anyway, that was that. Anyway, we went through the menus, done everything, chose everything. Off she went. Never thought no more of it. And then on the day of this party, I'm standing there cooking away in the basement, like basement kitchen. We just finished lunch service. And there's two guys standing in the kitchen, like in trench coats and earpieces and that. And one of them just walked up and he put his hand on my shoulder and he said, Graham, can you come with us for a minute? And I was like, who's this? And how's he know? And it was, yeah, it was the chief of Scotland Yard and the chief of the Buckingham Palace security. And they just went up and they started looking at different vantage points around the building and going through the bookings book to see, and they knew all the names in there. And anyone they didn't know, they said, get onto the palace, see if anyone knows there. And it was like, it was an eye-opener, I tell you, it was really weird. And yeah, and then that night, bosh, car pulls up outside, in they walk, she walks in, they take her upstairs, cook dinner. No one checked a thing, like what we cooked or anything.
What did you cook?
I remember the main course was sea bass with something. So there was sea bass, there was saffron risotto. We used to do this little savoran, baked savoran, like a barber, that was filled with like creamed wild mushrooms. It had like a poached egg on it. I can't remember the rest. I remember one at the cheese course. We gave them a vacheron either end of the table with all the bread in it. So they had to actually pass it around and get involved. And I heard that the Queen was like quite happy with that, shoes off under the table. It was, you know, it was a private dinner, and it was apparently her first private dinner in God knows how many years. You know, she, other than everything else she'd ever gone out for, would be a proper, you know, proper official engagement kind of thing. So yeah, we got to quite late, got to about 12:45 or something, and they could still hear them upstairs, and they had police sat like plain clothes, sat at tables in the restaurant and that. And I just stand on the stairs, oven cloth on and stuff, and the guy said to me, oh, they'll be wrapping it up soon. They said, you know, it's very late, obviously. They must be having a good time, because this wouldn't normally happen. And then the earpieces went, and they started to get them down the stairs to go out. And as they all came down the stairs, one of the guests who kind of been there before knew me, was with her. He said, oh, the Majesty, this is Graham, the chef. And she stopped. I just shook her hand. We stood and had a chat, and it all kind of, you see them all wait and stop. And we just had a chat on the stairs, and that, she was lovely. Yeah, it's just really normal. It's not talking to any other customer. It's just at the end when you have to stop yourself leaning in for a peck on the cheek.
Oh, that would have been really cute. I bet you should have been fine with that.
But yeah, she was great. It was, but yes, it don't really hit you till afterwards when she'd gone. Like, I remember getting out on my motorbike and I was just phoning home my mum. I was just saying to my mum, oh, guess who I didn't tonight? I was helped the Queen, you know. It's quite a big deal. Brilliant. But no, it was good. It was quite a cool
thing. You mentioned Harrison Ford. I mean, didn't he love a pork recipe of yours?
Oh yeah, we had we had a French waiter kept coming down saying, this American upstairs, he wants to come and talk to you. And I said, oh yeah, all right. And then afterwards it was like, tell him I've gone kind of thing, busy, you know. And it was like, and he kept on and on and on. So at that point I said, oh yeah, whatever. So I walked up to the restaurant and he came down, and the American that was actually asked him was, or no, the guy that was asked him was actually Tom Stoppard, but I didn't know who he was. So it's like, and it was Tom Stoppard was in there discussing a film script with Harrison Ford, and Tom Stoppard said, can you come and chat to my friend, he really, you know, wants to know about your pork and that. So I went up, and as soon as I walked in, the guy started asking me how he cooked it, and he was talking about how he does eat. And I was thinking, it's Harrison Ford. This is just the most bizarre thing, really. But oh, yeah,
so much fun.
Yeah, there's loads of that stuff. We get it now. We get some really cool people in here now.
Yeah. You know,
so, yeah, I used to think it was just because we were in London, but no, it's not.
I'm going to have to make my way down there.
Yeah.
Right, so I wanted to talk about your book, because it is absolutely phenomenal. Love it. It's come recently, but I wanted to just show you something very quickly in here, which is quite a sweet little story. So when you talk about babyhood.
All right, yeah.
I'm just going to show everyone this. There's this picture of you. I don't know if you can see it.
Yeah. I'm the one on the left.
Yeah. Yeah, that's you there, just so I can show everyone. And my husband, actually, who grew up in Bermondsey, right. He has almost exactly the same look as you. So it's the same hairstyle, the same coat, and the same little monkey.
Yeah, we've probably got the same mother.
I just thought, you guys, it's unbelievable how you look alike in as kids.
It's quite scary, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Yeah. Brother from another mother. But yeah. Your book is absolutely beautiful. I love the way you've put in your autobiography and you've brought in your recipes from your, you know, memories from all these different places. And it's absolutely fabulous. So I recommend everyone actually pick up this book. It's called Sex, Drugs and Sausage Rolls. So
yeah. And we're actually selling them from the restaurant now as well. So
signed copies.
They can be, yeah.
Brilliant. That's another reason for me to come down.
Pretty valued, isn't it? But yeah. we're always signing them from here. But no, yeah, we'll be selling them from here soon. So.
Yeah. Well, it's absolutely lovely, lovely book. So, Graham, it's been amazing chatting with you. I have one last question for you, which is tell me something about yourself I couldn't possibly know. So it's something that's not in the book and nothing you told me today.
You know what? It's so hard because pretty much
everything's in the book.
I bared all for that book, and the only thing, the stories that are not in the book were mainly because they were taken out because they were deemed either libelous or too unsavoury. I was gonna tell you about my what I'd been doing. As far as the producing Jack and Daisy, but I've already told you about that.
So, yeah, you have.
Now that makes it really, really difficult to think of anything.
You have got so many stories up your sleeve.
There's hundreds, but I mean, I can't remember what ones are in the book and what are not now. Either. I do know that. Let me think of something that I can legally say. So. I think we took most of this out of the book, but I know it's okay now because I saw him on Loose Women the other day and it came out. So Brian May from Queen, when he was first dating Anita Dobson, he was this got taken out of the book because it would have clashed with his divorce, because obviously it was before. Yeah. But I saw it came out on the telly the other day, so we were recording in a studio in Fulham at the time called Maison Rouge, and it was like gated, so we had a bar in there and it's pretty much anything goes behind closed doors in there, so it was kind of handy for them to meet. So they used to conduct their affair in our studio time while we were recording. So Brian would be, so he'd be in the studio listening to what we were doing and that, and saying, oh, you know, do you want any backing vocals and that on it, and we were like, brilliant, we've got Brian May's gonna sing on this track. But then Anita Dobson would always, oh, fantastic, and seeing there we'd all go, nah, you're all right. So it was quite a weird time, and it's also quite strange because I'd known him from years before. He'd kind of always been around my career somehow, from Dumb Blondes, because they were involved in Queen's original management. So you'd always bump into Brian May periodically every few years, and he was great at chatting or advice on that. And then I was touring, we were supporting Roger Taylor from Queen, his band, The Cross. And we got to the end of tour party at a town and country club in London, which I think is called The Forum now. And we were in the upstairs bar. And Jackie, my partner, she always used to say to me, oh, Brian May used to be my teacher at Stockwell Manor. And I was like, yeah, whatever. And anyway, we're standing in the bar and I said to Brian, I said, can you do me a favour? I said, Jackie always reckons that you used to teach her at Stockwell Manor. He went, oh yeah, that's right, I was a supply teacher there. And I went, can you come and say hello? So I took him over and I said, this is Jackie and Brian. And he remembered her name, he remembered her classmates' names.
Which was
the most impressive thing ever. So yeah, top bloke. There you go. You can have that one.
That is lovely, actually. Well, thank you so much for sharing that.
Right.
And guys, if you want to keep up to date with what Graham's up to, you can find him on Instagram at Westhouse Biddenden, and I'm at Posh Nosh Gal. Thank you so much, Graham. It's been amazing chatting with you.
And you. Thanks very much.